Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's special episode recorded live at ClioCon, I speak with John Grant. John worked in the technology industry for a decade before going to law school, and then went on to practice in-house in his own law firm and as the executive director of the Commons Law Center in Portland, Oregon, which worked to fill the access to civil justice gap for people who qualify for legal aid or didn't qualify for free legal services but couldn't afford full-cost legal services. Now John primarily works coaching and consulting with lawyers at his company Agile Professionals. He's a graduate of Tufts, Go Jumbos, and Lewis and Clark School of Law. In our conversation, we discuss John's path and then his path to counseling lawyers to work smarter, not harder. If you're a lawyer or law student who just feels overwhelmed by how much you have to do and wants to gain a little more control, this is the episode for you. Here's our conversation. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. I'm live here at ClioCon in Nashville interviewing lawyers and legal tech experts. And today I'm excited to speak with John Grant, who in his words is a lawyer who helps lawyers suck less through his company, Agile Attorney Consulting. I love that. He worked in the technology industry for a decade before going to law school and now trains lawyers to work better, as well as a host of other tasks. So before we dive into what you do today, John, I'm curious about your path to the law. What made you decide to become a lawyer? How'd you get into our profession?
Yeah, so this is a little bit, well, I don't know how traditional it is or not. I am a fourth generation lawyer. My great grandfather kind of helped invent the field of entertainment law.
Cool.
And his client list is probably the coolest one I've ever come across. You know, his B clients were like Joe DiMaggio and Shirley Temple. His A client was Howard Hughes.
Heard of him.
Yeah, there's funny stories about, for my great grandmother lived to be 102. So I got like good firsthand stories from her. And they were forced to install a phone in the 1940s in their bedroom, and they'd get a call at 3 a.m., and all it would be was, Mr. Hughes would like to go for a drive, because he was famously paranoid.
Sure.
So they would go talk business. I always imagined on Mulholland Drive
right.
in their fancy Howard Hughes limousine
talking
shop. So a lot of, having a lawyer, he was an ABA president, he was an international bar president, he was a bigwig. And so that created a very much a lawyer culture within my family.
Oh, sure.
And a lot of reverence for lawyering, which meant that once I was, 21 and graduated from law school or from undergrad, I wanted nothing to do with it.
Right. Exactly.
As far as I could possibly get. So I went to Seattle because it was the coolest place to live in the 90s and got a job with a small startup called Photodisc.
Okay.
And Photodisc had figured out how to deliver photography initially on CD, as the name implied. In fact, they started on floppy disk.
Oh, wow.
But then had the dumb luck that Netscape Navigator showed up. And they were one of the first companies, asterisk, other than porn, to both take the order and deliver the order across the internet.
Wow. Right?
Because we had digitized photography.
And that's such, that's so commonplace. It's part of our everyday life and everything we
yeah.
do. It's amazing to think that that wasn't commonplace.
That had to be invented.
Right,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah. And what wound up happening is we caught the attention of a guy named Mark Getty, who came from a little family money himself. And
right.
he had a fledgling company called Getty Images that merged with Photodisc because what Mark and his partner, Jonathan Klein, understood was that even though the image was maybe a little bit lower res, even though there were some potential issues relative to moving slides around
sure.
in the physical world, which was the old way to do it, the convenience to the customer would be an unfair advantage. And they, in acquiring or buying, I think it's technically a merger, in buying Photodisc, they recognize the technological tools to create vastly superior customer experiences. And in doing so, they consolidated the stock photography industry around themselves.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
It really is. And it's something that, again, we take for granted in so many different industries. You know, a lot of my listeners are junior lawyers and law students who are more than just digital natives. The internet is something that's been around since they were born. Like, I remember...
Right.
getting dial-up internet in my house. I remember getting our first computer, but like the people 10 or 15 years behind me, that was happening when they were born.
Yes.
And, or before they were born. And so it's a totally different ballgame. So you're having this fascinating tech career in the coolest tech city in the world. What sends you to law school?
So I went on this rocket ship ride in the 90s with Getty, and it was great. I think I had 22 different business card titles in about 7 years. And eventually, like while Getty was doing the job of consolidating the industry, it was amazing and exciting. And then they started to have to pivot into defending the turf that they have just consolidated. And it was just different. It wasn't for me. When you've done that exciting part. And so I stepped out and I did some consulting with some smaller startups. But as a plan B, I took the LSAT.
Okay. The first person to have a plan B of taking the LSAT.
Yes. And that created a whole momentum. And I wound up in law school, obviously, and loved it. I think partly being a little bit older, a little bit more experienced. You know, I used to have to report directly to the CEO and the CFO of Getty. And so there was no law professor that would scare me with the Socratic method. I'd been there, done that.
Right.
And there were actual stakes as opposed to the imaginary stakes.
Right. The perceived stakes of law school. And I guess the other follow-up to that is for students who are coming to law school, you know, either after a few years working or as a true second career, especially having a little bit of distance from that, what were some of the things you learned about how to be successful in law school, despite maybe not looking like or having the same experiences as the other people sitting in classroom with you?
You know, one of the things that I learned, I graduated from undergrad in an era where laptops weren't practical. And so it was very much the physical note-taking world. And then by the time I went to law school, laptops were practical and it became the norm. And I thought that what I should be doing was note-taking and organizing all my things on a laptop. And it took me until about 3/4 of the way through my 1L year to realize that I was getting really good at transcribing dictation, but I wasn't actually learning.
Yes.
And so reverting back, not just to, you know, I think there's science and other things around how the handwritten note is actually a far superior way to consume and remember information. But even aside from that, I think the lesson is don't be afraid. I'm going to sound like the old grandpa. don't be afraid of sticking with the things that work for you.
Yeah.
Like even if there's something else and there's, you know, the new hotness, whatever it happens to be, right? Tried and true is there for a reason.
Right. There's definitely a shiny new toy syndrome way of doing law school. And look, I think social media and myself included and other professors, you know, we're trying to help by talking about how to do well in law school because it's such, there's this hidden curriculum and a lot of people are behind as a result.
Yes.
And so we're trying to make the hidden curriculum less hidden. But something that I've been seeing a lot more of, and I totally agree, is don't forget what worked and why. And bring that with you, even if the world has changed around you a little.
Yeah. So you don't know it, but you just segue into my favorite topic, which is the Kanban methodology.
Love it. I love it. I love it. Please tell me more.
So Kanban, K-A-N-B-A-N, and it's, I won't go into the whole deep history except to say that it sort of has had two different genesises, one of them in the lean manufacturing industry, and then it sort of had a rebirth in the agile software development methodology, and it has sort of evolved, at least the agile flavor of Kanban has evolved into its own standalone methodology. And the two things that come to mind that are part of the sort of core tenets of Kanban, and some people, if you're from the Midwest and you want to call it Kanban, I'm totally fine with that. But number one is when you're engaging in analysis and improvement of any process, start with what you do now.
Okay.
Respect the status quo. There's a reason you got to where you are, and you shouldn't begin an improvement process with change. You should begin an improvement process with understanding.
Okay.
So that's number one, right? And so again, what's working for you, if it's physical notes, if it's digital notes, if it's, you know, if you've got a rocket book or a, you know, any of these various tools.
Sure.
Whiz bang gizmos.
Right.
then it's cool. If it works for you, it's great. The second thing is you talked about exposing the hidden curriculum. And the second tenet of the Kanban methodology is make the work visible. And there's sort of a hidden parenthesis behind that, ironically maybe, which is all of the work. Make all of the work visible.
And say more about what you mean by all of the work in that context.
Well, so, you know, one of the great tools of the Kanban methodology is a Kanban board. And you know, it's funny, when I first started beating this drum 10 plus years ago, nobody knew what a Kanban board is. Now everyone is, you know, there's Kanban.
Even if they don't know that's what it's called, they've probably seen it.
They've seen it. They're using it, right? I mean, half of the tools down on the exhibition floor use a Kanban interface of some way. And the one that most people have probably come across is Trello.
Okay, so say more. To somebody who knows nothing about a Kanban board, can you explain it?
Yeah, so a Kanban board is basically work organized in a series of columns. And one way to explain it is relative to the checklist. So a checklist has two states. It has work that is done, where it's checked, and it has work that is not done, which is unchecked. It doesn't have a state for in progress. And so one of the challenges with a checklist is that there is the ability to have a lot of partially finished work that is not manifest in the checklist methodology. And some people hack this, right? They circle it if it's in progress.
Right.
I'm not saying it's like universally true, but that's the challenge with a checklist is something is either checked or not checked. It's binary. The Kanban board in its most fundamental structure adds a third state. So it takes work and there's basically three columns and the typical columns are to do, doing, and done. So it introduces that doing state, that in progress state. And then the work on the board, and in the old days and still really right up into the pandemic, I really clung to my sticky notes.
Okay.
And I still think that the best way of teaching this methodology
is analog.
Is analog, right? Because there's just something about the tactile nature of interacting with the sticky notes that is really helpful. So you take the sticky notes, if you've put blue painter's tape on the wall to create three columns, and you've labeled them ready, doing, and done, or to do, doing, and done, then the work itself becomes a task on a sticky note. And there's one note per task or one note per work item. And that work progresses from not done or ready into doing or in progress and gets all the way through to done. And by making even that very fundamental workflow visible, it changes your perception of what your task list looks like.
Okay.
It gives it physical form. And again, part of what I like about sticky notes is they actually take up physical space. And if you are overburdening yourself with too much to do,
right,
you will see it. It will jump off the wall at you.
Right. There can't be too many things in that middle column because too many things in the middle column means you're not going to get any of them done.
Ah, well, so that I was just talking about the to do column.
Okay, and sorry. You're talking about progress column.
So you're talking about the in progress column, which is great because you segued me to one of the third tenets of Kanban, which is limit work in progress.
Okay.
And what you just said, right? So if you have, I forget who it was, but if you have more than three priorities, you have no priorities,
right?
And so limiting work in progress or work in process, different people call it different things, is basically saying, and one of the things I talk about with my clients all the time is one of the first and hardest things to do is to have what I call an honest reckoning with capacity.
Lawyers are not great at that.
We're not great
as a profession.
Humans aren't great at it. It's
fair.
True. Like humans are not. We're wired. There's literally a bias called the optimism bias that causes us to look at work and say, number one, that's not as big a project as it actually is.
Sure.
And number two, the optimism bias applies to ourselves as well. So we're like, oh, I'm going to be really good at doing that work.
Right.
And so if you think it's small and you think you're going to be good at it, and then you collide that with reality, that's a dangerous situation.
Sure.
And so the work in progress limit forces us to say, okay, I can only do so many things at a time. I have to have an honest reckoning with my capacity. The flip side of that is what I refer to as the brutal assessment of priorities, right? And it literally, like I toyed with a lot of different words before I landed on brutal, but it's brutal,
yeah.
Right? This idea, it's hard to say, I can only get so much done. Therefore, I have to be brutal about what I allow into my system.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, and this is, I'm unintentionally going through all of the tenets of Kanban.
Sure.
One of them is to maximize flow. And very specifically in a Kanban board, you want work to flow from the left side of the board to the right side of the board as you're looking at it. So you want it to start with ready, you want it to move to in progress, and you want it to move through in progress to done. You don't want backflow, and right. you don't want stagnation. And so one of the things when we overload our capacity, we wind up having to have squirrel holes for work in progress.
Right.
And there's a couple of things that come into play. One is we overcommit early and we say, okay, even though I should only have a WIP limit of 3, I'm going to commit to doing 6.
WIP being work in progress.
Work in progress, yes, thank you. And I should say for anyone that's done a big law clerkship, this WIP is different from law firm WIP. Law firm WIP is a very specific number that is hours you've worked but haven't billed yet.
Right, totally different concept.
Well, it's a form of WIP,
yeah.
right? It is a form of work in progress, but it's a very narrow definition.
Got it.
And I'm thinking of a much broader definition.
Got it.
But what winds up happening once we've overcommitted is then we have to have waiting stages and, you know, again, these sort of squirrel holes. Or sometimes we start something and we realize, oh, we didn't have all of what we needed to get this all the way to done.
Totally.
And so now I have to push it back to some prior stage, which again, I can't believe I'm doing this off the top of my head, is one of the next tenets of Kanban, which is make policies explicit, which doesn't mean make them R-rated. It means basically be really genuine and express about what are my rules for processing work. And so when I'm building a Kanban board for someone,
yeah.
there's usually more than one part of the in-progress column, right? So if it's an estate planning practice, there's a gathering of information stage, and then there's a strategic planning stage, and then there's an initial drafting stage, and then there's a client feedback stage.
So just to sort of, so I can visualize what that looks like,
mm-hmm.
that's taking that middle column, the in-progress column, and kind of expanding it into sub-columns.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's been, an explosion diagram if you've,
Got
done
it.
Any, car repair.
Well,
things like that.
So I want to step back for a second
because
I think this is fantastic and so brass tacks, which is what I love about doing on the podcast. And
yeah.
I actually use some form of this with my teaching assistants.
Perfect.
So like, I can't wait to have them listen to this because it'll you do a much better job explaining the what and the why than I do. What I want to take a step back and ask about is how is this actually something that lawyers can use?
Yeah.
And then before we end, I want to hear about why. Like, what's the
yeah.
pitch? So start with the what, and then we'll go to the why.
Okay. So I think of there as being, and again, right, I like systems, workflows, pipelines, I sometimes call them, right? And in any law practice, I think of there as being, and really any business, there are sort of three high-level pipelines or systems. There's your getting the work system, which is biz dev, sales, marketing, branding, if you go that far forward, et cetera. There is your delivery system, and then there's your getting paid system. And again, as I walk the exhibition floor downstairs here, and as I listen to a lot of the talks here at ClioCon, there are a ton of people and companies trying to help you improve your getting the work system, which makes sense.
Right.
There are slightly fewer, but also a lot of companies trying to help you improve your getting paid system. There are very few people here that are trying to help you actually improve your delivery system. And the thing that I keep running into with my clients and people who aren't my clients is if you optimize for your getting the work system, you will automatically overburden your delivery system if your delivery can't keep up.
Right.
And I won't go into the details of Little's Law, but the more work you push into that system, the longer it takes for any one work unit to get through to the done stage on the other side.
Right.
And so by one of the things I often talk about with my clients is you have to actually be, so at the end of the day, Kanban is a signaling system. And it's a system where you say, oh, I have capacity here in the drafting phase. How do I signal upstream that I am ready for more work in the drafting phase, right?
So whatever that happens. Can I give you an example? Like, can
sure.
we make it super concrete? So like before I became a law professor, before I started a podcast as an unpaid side hustle, I was a big law litigator.
Okay.
And I worked on big litigation matters
big, yeah.
that had multiple team members, multiple levels, partners and associates, client deliverables at all sorts of times. And trial was so far in the future.
Totally.
We were not even thinking. I mean, we were always thinking about trial, but we weren't actually thinking about doing tasks for trial.
Right.
It was document discovery, client interviews, learning the business, lots of different pieces.
Yes.
And one of the biggest challenges that I found as sort of a mid-level who was responsible for, you know, keeping the agenda for the team.
Right.
Right. People would write me and say, here's what I'm doing. And the partner would say, well, I just asked, you know, John to do this. And one of the things I always thought in those moments was, this is not a great way to manage, right? Even the best managers who really knew what their associates were doing or fellow partners were doing.
Right.
It's not a great way to manage a pipeline of a ton of tasks.
Right.
And a ton of people who are eligible to do those tasks, but with varying levels of bandwidth.
Yes.
And it sounds like this approach rethinks that a little bit.
It does. And I think part of what you're describing, and it's a different set of problems, right? And one of the things I have done work with Big Law, I ultimately realized that I care a lot about access to justice.
Sure.
I care a lot about people. I have a hard time bringing myself to care about the kinds of problems that big law firms have.
Fair.
but I have done work with Big Law. And part of what you're describing is that the thing that we call complex litigation is actually an aggregation of hundreds of other little systems and workflows.
Sure.
And subtasks. And so part of what I like about this methodology is that it allows you to see that aggregation where it's happening and sort of create some breathing room between those systems and disaggregate.
Yeah.
Right? Because what often happens is that a bottleneck in just one part of that overall system is the thing that limits the capacity of the entire team for the entire system.
100%.
And so by disaggregating, by pulling apart, and whether that's a column on a board or in a complex litigation, it might be that there are 10 different boards.
Right.
And, you know, there are folks that are doing this kind of thing, Jay Oom and Casey Flaherty, that are doing it at the big law level. So this is not, you know, Jason Barnwell at Microsoft is doing this, sort of trying to push it upstream from his perspective as in-house counsel.
Right.
Into the firms that are serving Microsoft with, you know, some success, but not, it's bumpy,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
It's new, it's hard.
Right, it's new processes for old lawyers. That's a hard sell.
It's not just new processes. It's really, it is a very new way of thinking.
Right.
And it's wow, a new so way of looking at it.
Bigger than that.
Yeah. And I mean, part of it is I think it's a more, once you sort of get into it, it's a more intuitive way of thinking. One of the things I talk about a lot is that the columns on a Kanban board and the cards that represent the work on the board are all a visual fiction, which means they're not actually your work. But in knowledge work, we don't ever see it anyway. And so by creating this visual fiction, right, humans that have the ability to see tend to be very visual people. It is one of the primary pathways through which we make sense of the world around us.
Right.
And so by creating this visual fiction, it does a lot for our sense-making capabilities, and it makes it easier to say, oh, I need to prioritize this over that. I'll give you the example. When I was working for a big law firm, I was the head of legal project management for a while. And a lot of what I did was one-on-one work with associates.
Yeah.
And we would create personal Kanban boards for them, relatively simple, right? Basically a demand column or a, you know, to-do column, a working column, maybe a, you know, third-party review or a client review column for when there was actually that stage, and then a done. And they would color code different projects for work they were doing for different partners.
Matters or partners.
Yeah. And sometimes different matters, sometimes different partners.
Sure.
But if partner A comes in, you know, waving a file and saying, this is on fire.
That's never happened to me. I have no idea what you're talking about. No, I'm just joking.
Right. It's actually, it gives the associates both some agency and a framework to direct them to the board and say, hey, my next priority task is actually for partner B.
Right.
And I'm happy to slot you in, right? This is the place where it fits, but I can't bump partner B without partner B's permission.
Right.
So if you want your fire to take over priority for partner B's fire, you got to go take it up with them. And guess what? Oh, no, no, no. It's fine. I can do this. I can be third. I see now what you're working on, and I can be third. Or if it is truly a fire, then they march on down to Partner B's office.
Right, and they work it out. Yeah.
Say, yeah, I need John's attention.
And so you gave me the Big Law example because that's what I asked for.
Yes.
But I know that when you say your clients, a lot of them are small and medium-sized firms and more focused on sort of access to justice work. Tell me a little bit about how that model or process or approach fits on to those types of clients.
Yeah. So in the everyday client, I've done a lot of work with a lot of people that are doing non-hourly billing, which is not to say that this is exclusively this can work well for hourly billing, for hourly billers, although it often is the tip of the spear into exploring other pricing models, in part because it makes you more efficient, and efficiency is not the financial friend of the billable hour.
Right, I was going to say. Yeah.
Right. And again, most lawyers are not as committed to their, oh, I love my hourly billing, right? They want the revenue to be there.
Right.
And that makes sense. And so partly this is a understanding how you work within this Kanban framework helps give you the confidence, and we also use a lot of data, right? The data-driven decision-making, to be able to say, oh, like this thing that I was charging hourly on, I now can deliver in 10 hours what used to take me 25, and I'm taking a bath if I build.
Right.
I'm still creating the same value for my user. For my client. And so it gives you the confidence to say, oh, I can actually reasonably bill this at a flat fee, and I can convert this in a way. There's other things about flat, right? That's once you start to think about flat fee, and I'm going down a little bit of a rabbit hole, it forces you out of the idea that you offer legal services, and it forces you into the notion that you actually sell products. And that's a whole different, and I won't go too deep.
Yeah.
I actually tweeted at Jack already, and I think I've been accepted for ClioCon 2023 with my proposal to talk about product strategy for lawyers, because that is a whole, all the things that they've talked about here today and yesterday, to be anti-fragile, to develop different products on your pyramid, which Mark Britton talked about. All of that presupposes a fundamental understanding of product thinking, product management, product strategy, product marketing, product pricing. And that is a whole different set of disciplines that the legal industry hasn't absorbed yet.
Right. And how does this tie in, if at all, to sort of the access to justice piece? Is it just that because you're more efficient and you can either move away from the billable hour or charge fewer hours, we're making it more accessible?
So that is absolutely true.
Okay.
That's part of it. One of the other hats I wear, I'm the board president and one of the founders of a nonprofit law firm in Oregon called the Commons Law Center. And one of the big changes we made is beginning in 2022, we are no longer taking full scope family law clients. Family law is one of our four practice areas. And we're only doing phased, limited scope, flat fee engagements for family law. And we will, in fact, we would love for our clients to string each of those engagements and sort of daisy chain them together into something that approaches a full scope experience. But we know, because we serve people below 400% of the poverty level, that most of them can't afford that.
Got it.
And so by disaggregating the components of how we deliver family law services, and I use the word deliver intentionally, in partly because I am pretty insistent that delivering a service also requires a deliverable.
Okay.
Right? I refer to it as the tangible manifestation of value.
Okay.
But the way we work now, we begin every one of our engagements with what we call a strategic legal assessment. Again, another quick tangent. We started by calling it a paid consultation, but so many lawyers have trained people that the word consultation is supposed to have the word free in front of
it.
That we got pushback from our clients. What do you mean? And some of our clients are legal aid qualified, but legal aid didn't have capacity, so they send us our way. So there's an expectation that legal work should be free, and we have to break that.
Right.
So we're try to be really intentional, and we're still getting better about feedback loop and talking with clients, not for the purposes of getting a review, but for the purposes of improving our product offerings.
Right.
And one of the early pieces of feedback was, if it's a consultation, it should be free. So instead, we call it a strategic legal assessment.
Right.
And that's paid, But at the end of that strategic assessment, the client gets an after-visit summary, which we shamefully stole from the healthcare industry. And that after-visit summary has, instead of this was your pulse and this was your temperature, it's like, this is your issue, right? You're looking for a divorce, you don't have children, you do own a house, right? So we do that sort of diagnostic piece or that assessment piece. Here's what your roadmap looks like, right? And this is the typical roadmap for divorce in Oregon. And then at each milestone on the roadmap, these are your options. We almost always offer a DIY approach. So if you need to draft your own pleading, here's the Oregon Judicial Division court forms. So that's a DIY. We do a DIY plus, we don't call it that yet. That is, if you want to draft your own pleadings but have us review them before you file, then you can pay us a flat fee, limited scope engagement, to do that review. And maybe even if you pay us that plus a little bit more, we will file it for you.
Right.
Because the filing process is confusing.
Sure.
It's a pain in the butt.
Well, and what I love hearing about your practice and your sort of process or interest in Kanban and just process oriented work is here. I sort of hear the echoes of the board in the process of how you think about your practice of law.
And so I think that's the key, is that until we use Kanban boards, and the Commons has been using Kanban boards for 5 years now, but until we use Kanban boards and we could actually see the different sort of service desks that we have within our practice and understand how an order comes in for that service, what the requirements of that service are, what the deliverable for that service is, that led us to developing a product strategy that allowed us to say, oh, this is valuable all by itself.
Right.
100%. And of course, we have a do it for you option for most of those steps as well. And a lot of people buy them, because even people who do not have great financial means still are willing to buy the security and the confidence and even sort of the camaraderie, or the, like, someone's in this with me.
Right.
The consortium of having a lawyer actually do it on their behalf.
Makes a ton of sense. We're coming towards the end of our chat, and we could go on forever, because this is really, really interesting. So I want to end with two questions. The first is to go back to that why. If you're a lawyer and you hear this, and you hear Kanban and Agile, and you're not a visual person, you can't see the board on the wall, what's the why of going and doing a little reading or a little listening to your work or other people's work? What's the why for the lawyer?
It will unclog your delivery pipeline. I mean, that's just it. There are very few lawyers that I talk to that don't have some combination of either a worry that something is falling through the cracks, a fear, or even a guilt that they should be doing more than they are, and also a sense of sort of lost opportunity, that if they could unlock how to do more or not have things through the cracks, then they could grow their practice in some way. And part of what I talk about, you know, I on my website, you'll see that I try to help lawyers create a profitable, scalable, and sustainable practice for themselves and the communities they care for. And so those three things, profitability, scalability, and sustainability, are all important legs of the tool. And I think a lot of lawyers maybe are running a little over the red line, maybe a lot over the red line a lot of the time, and that's not sustainable.
Right.
But they're doing it in service of their revenue goals.
Right.
Whereas if we could sort of back up and, again, pull it apart, take a deep breath, and actually see the products for what they are, there's so much potential in most law practices once you actually see it.
And once you can see the landscape,
Know
that things aren't going to fall off because you have trusted systems, be able to take some things out of your brain so that you can be present in whatever you're doing. Because I think that's something I hear from a lot of lawyers on the podcast, is work-life balance is huge, particularly for young parents.
Yep.
But that really the hardest part is the inputs are just flying.
Exactly.
And that takes a lot of mental energy, even when you're at your kid's soccer game, right? Yes. The inputs in your brain of, like, okay, I'm watching a game, but I know tomorrow I have to do X. Or if I don't do Y tonight, tomorrow's going to be terrible. And being able to see that feels like a good first step.
It's incredibly relaxing is not quite the right word, but it puts people's minds at ease.
Liberating. Yeah. It's great.
Well, and it does, you know, in some ways, the Kanban board serves as an external brain for that purpose. When I first started, again, in the big law sector, when I was doing this with paralegals, one of the things I heard a lot was, oh, I am like resting so much easier overnight because I know I don't have to load I don't have to keep the program of my legal deliverables in my active memory.
Right.
It's a very computer metaphor.
But yeah, I was going to say that sounds like a technologist yes. turned lawyer.
Right. I think it's very real, right?
Yeah,
we keep these things in your brain. You know, we all are natural worriers and your brain will spin on that to-do list or that priority list. But when it is captured on a board and it's there on the wall or in your, you know, legalboards.io, which right. got announced as an integration with Clio yesterday morning, then your brain will rest because like, oh, it'll be there when I get back to the office.
I love that.
I don't have to spin it.
Brain rest. I think every lawyer could use a little extra brain
so
rest.
Too.
Which brings me to my last question, which is the same question I ask all my guests, which is sort of for a piece of advice for people just entering our profession.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be from your various areas of practice that we've talked about, or it could be something more process focused, but what's something you would leave someone who's either just graduating law school or in their first 2 years of practice?
So one of the things I try to encourage people, new lawyers, and this is easier for people that had a pre-law career than it is for people that are the K through JD,
sure.
But law school spends 3 years teaching you how to think like a lawyer. But you have to like remember that kernel of how to think like a human.
I love that.
And you really like there's a lot of practice and procedure and custom and culture in the legal industry that is built because we have this adherence to precedent mindset.
Yep.
We have this stare decisis idea, like this idea that this is how things are done. And if you ask why, well, it just is, or because we've always done it this way. And I really encourage people to keep that kernel of doubt, right? I want people to have that Ron Popeil moment of there has to be a better way.
Yeah.
And then go invent that better way.
I love that. Well, that's something I try to remind my students is that when they walk through my door to legal practice in their first year of law school, to not forget what they know, who they were,
yes.
the things they loved, the approaches they took, all of those things can inform their legal career and the legal career can sort of sit on top of them. They don't have to crush
Absolutely.
Everything that came through the door. So yeah. we're kindred spirits in that way.
One last
go
plug,
on, please.
Kanban boards are great for law students making sense of your demands for all your classes, even if you keep it on sort of a week by week basis.
What would that look like?
So you could have a different color code for different classes. You could have different task types for research versus writing versus
yes.
review.
Right.
You can basically, again, honest reckoning with your capacity, understanding this is the demand. Maybe I should be doing reading, writing, and review on all of my classes, but I don't actually have the capacity to do that.
Right. So you have to make choices.
I have to make choices.
Sure.
I have to prioritize. And so using a Kanban board, and again, I love a wall with sticky notes, but Trello is free.
Yeah.
And there's lots of other tools. Kanban Zone is one of my favorites that is relatively inexpensive. And you can build systems to reflect your study workload,
sure.
or writing workload, if you're doing an externship on top of it, or if you're a teaching assistant, right?
Right.
That adds to your demands. If you've got to go to a kid's soccer game because you're, you know, a little bit older law student, that comes in too. You can
right.
track your family. I track my kids, my high schooler tracks his homework on a Kanban.
I love that. Well, as a parent of slightly younger children, I hope to introduce them to Kanban boards before they're too old. And I will say, I do use Kanban boards with my teaching assistants. And we use it for a very specific purpose, which is we get 57 1L memos and
right.
they have to take the first cut. I take the second cut yeah. and it needs to happen in about 9 days.
Yes.
And I didn't want, I was a teaching assistant in the program and I remember all the email and you have no sense of what the professor's timeline is, what
Correct.
Your co-teaching assistant's timeline is. And so we start with those 57 cards on one side and we slowly work them through until they're all done.
Yes.
And the biggest thing for my teaching assistants is they like knowing where everyone else is in the process.
Yes.
Because it gives them permission to either work ahead mm-hmm. or take more time, because they know that I'm only one person, and I always tell them I want to be the cog in the machine. The yes. problem is when my stack is empty, that's a problem.
Yes.
Because when I have bandwidth and I have a lot more students
Nothing
than
to
they do.
Do,
that's the problem. But it yes. doesn't matter to me which of those
Absolutely.
Papers are in my board, because they have to get there. So that's another sort of like limited use example that I think has been really helpful for me as a teacher.
But this is the thing, is it's all, they're all limited use examples. So, right, you've defined a process, you've identified your work units, you've identified your process phases, and you've identified your available resources. And using a board, you have basically created a little assembly
sure.
line for taking raw materials through to finished products.
I love right? it.
And that's what it's for.
Fantastic. Well, look, John, it's been great. I hope we can do this again sometime. Best of luck in all of your various
Thank you.
Endeavors. And where can people find you if they want to learn more?
I am at agileattorney.com. If you Google, well, there's a few different people talking about Kanban for lawyers now, which is great. But I was one of the first. So if you Google Agile Attorney, is probably the fastest way to get to me. I'm also on Twitter at JEGrant3.
Great. Well, thanks so much for doing this.
Yep. Thanks, Bye. Jonah.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.